jump right in here and turn it over to our very first speaker today. So we are very fortunate to have another speaker joining us to help introduce our session. So Carla Hare has been a former FRT, our steering committee chair, and she is currently with the environmental, she's the Environmental Restoration Division Director at the Naval Facilities Engineering and Expeditionary Warfare Center. So Carla, I don't want to eat up any more time. I want to turn it over to you so that you can welcome our guests today.
Sounds great, Jean. Well, I do want to give a big welcome to everyone who's joined us here for the second session of the FRTR spring meeting. So good morning, good afternoon, and maybe even in some cases, good evening. I'm so happy that we can meet online and, you know, reach across the country. I think we have several hundred on the phone. I know we did last Wednesday. And maybe even some people are joining us from other countries. So that's really exciting. I've been honored to be working with the FRTR for close to 20 years. So that's not quite since the inception, which was just over 30 years ago of the FRTR, but it's been enough for me to, you know, personally see the collaboration, the camaraderie, and the learning that we all share among our federal agencies in remediation technologies. And this group really is amazing. It's not only helped me personally grow and be more competent in my own career within environmental restoration, but I can see how it's greatly benefited our federal agencies and specifically my Navy organization, the Naval Facilities Engineering Systems Command. I mean, there's no doubt that we're more informed, we've made better cleanup decisions, and we've pursued optimization approaches and technologies. And it's, you know, a large part because of our involvement with FRTR. So I'm really excited for the future of this organization and what it can bring to our agencies and to individuals also. If you could go on to the next slide, Jean. So we are at the point in the road here where we want to pause and reassess and reconfirm and focus in on the areas for FRTR where we want to work in the future. So our meeting is appropriately titled FRTR at 30 Years, Grand Challenges and Opportunities for Advancing Remediation Technologies. And that's, you know, specifically why we met last Wednesday and are meeting again today. So last Wednesday's session, of course, we heard from our agencies and our agency leaders on what the top remediation challenges are and how we can use innovative and advanced technologies and in what areas in order to make progress. And actually, there were some potentially new areas that came up in the conversation too. So our first speaker today is going to recap for us the highlights from last Wednesday's session one. So don't worry if you missed it. I think you'll be able to catch up and get up to speed. And then today, our second speaker is going to review the survey response questions. There was an FRTR agency leadership questionnaire, and we will review the questions specifically on the innovative remediation technologies today. But really the highlight of today's session is going to be the panel discussion. We're going to get to hear from each of the agencies on capabilities, on their capabilities and directions in research and application of remediation technologies. And we're going to discuss how we can collaborate with each other and move in a great direction in those areas. So the hope and the purpose of today really is to walk away from this meeting with some clarity about how FRTR as a collaborative multi-agency group can best serve the remediation community. If you can go on to the next slide, Jean, that would be great. So the work doesn't stop today at 3:30 Eastern when our webinar ends. The steering committee members listed here on this slide will work to review the information we've learned. We're going to gather information from the panel discussions, from the surveys, and from any additional information that the participants in today's meetings and last Wednesday's meetings will provide. We want to look for forming partnerships, We want to look to interact with the state and the private industry, and we want to share lessons learned, and we want to make sure that we're doing it in the right areas that's going to benefit the environmental community. So with that, I hope that you enjoyed today's sessions. Actually, I know you will. And I want to thank our speakers too, who I know spent much time in preparation for being here today. And we're excited to hear from you. So with that, our first speaker is Ms. Tanya Gallegos. And I'm going to introduce her right now. Tanya is a research engineer at the USGS Survey, US Geological Survey in Reston, Virginia, and a licensed professional engineer in New Mexico. She received a PhD in Environmental and Water Resources Engineering from the University of Michigan and an MS in Civil Engineering from the University of New Mexico. She has been a member of the FRTR Steering Committee since 2017. Welcome, Tanya.
Thank you, Carla. I'm going to be presenting the highlights from session one from last week, entitled Grand Challenges, Research Gaps, and Priorities. And this is on behalf of the FRTR Steering Committee. Next slide, please. Last week, we had 349 participants from many different sections or sectors of the cleanup community, ranging from engineering firms, state, federal, local governments, as well as academia, site owners, technology vendors, and at least one testing laboratory. Next slide, please. And so last week, as Carla said, we focused on some of the challenges related to remediation. And so we heard from senior leaders talk about the challenges that their agencies are facing over the next decade. We also talked about some of the technology needs and research gaps associated with those challenges. And next slide, please. And so we thought we'd focus first on recapping some of those grand challenges. And these included things like remaining difficult to remediate sites. And some of these sites are difficult because they have contaminant plumes with long tails, perhaps complex groundwater hydrology or recalcitrant contaminants. We also talked about the challenges related to effective source and site characterization, which could really benefit remedy decision and design implementation. We also talked about challenges in evaluating the long-term uncertainty and effectiveness of remediation remedies that have been applied. We had quite a bit of discussion as well on emerging contaminants, specifically the PFAS contaminant classes. But we also talked about some of these contaminants that have been around for a long time, which have now emerging science that would lead us to think about these in a different way. We also talked about the concept of the valley of death. And this is essentially the challenge related to moving these new technologies from the research phase all the way into full-scale field application and commercialization. We also talked quite a bit about climate and climate resiliency. Specifically, we talked about how does climate affect the efficacy of some of these remediation strategies that have been implemented. And also, we talked about sort of the converse, which is how do the remedies actually impact climate? For example, do these remedies emit greenhouse gases, or do they use up a lot of water? We also talked quite a bit about the loss of expertise and personnel, and this could primarily be due to things like retirements of senior personnel, and also how do we transfer the knowledge to the younger generation of cleanup professionals that are coming on. And so finally, we talked about the challenges associated with incorporating environmental justice into the cleanup processes. Next slide. And so associated with those challenges, we also discussed some of the needs that could help tackle some of those challenges. For example, we identified a need for training resources for the environmental remediation community. We also talked about the need for full-scale and off-the-shelf technology, not only for emerging contaminants, but also for some of those contaminants that have been around for a while. We talked about the need for technology information exchange and also a systems approach to making decisions in totality. For example, not just making a decision about a remedy based on the contaminant itself, but also the other factors that could impact it, such as, you know, geology or hydrology or climate change. We also talked about the need for characterization and performance monitoring methods, perhaps using some new innovative technologies such as robotic sensors. We talked about the need for mechanisms so that would facilitate exchange on information on decision-making and also how to evaluate and optimize remedy performance. There's a need for long-term cost performance data as well as better predictive models. And so these predictive models may not just be about, you know, the behavior of the contaminant and the efficacy of the remediation over time, but it could also mean better predictive models for, let's say, climate change and how those would impact remedies. And finally, we talked about some needs related to emerging contaminants. Specifically, we talked about the need for new tools, and these would be tools for characterizing, analyzing, and remediating these emerging contaminants. But we also talked about the need for new science. In some cases, we need new science and data and information so that we can better assess the fate and transport, the risk and the behavior associated with these emerging contaminants in the environment. Next slide, please. And so finally, last week, we left off with some recommendations for future activities. For example, we talked about a recommendation to identify, document, and discuss case studies. And these would be really helpful for facilitating technical expert exchanges, as well as coordinating the lessons learned from those exchanges. There was a recommendation to evaluate the new technologies that are coming into being and their associated QA/QC issues. And this would allow for more effective field applications and also provide greater data reliability. We also talked about a recommendation for using some of those, some of these really new innovative techniques that are coming into being, such as the use of artificial intelligence coupled with machine learning and data mining tools. And this would help for processing this wealth of information and data that come from historical remediation applications. And this could potentially lead us to better understanding remediation performance, especially in the long run, in long terms. And we also, there was a recommendation to continue to update the FRTR website, its technology screening matrix and decision support tools. There was also a recommendation to place cost-benefit analyses into the context of risk analysis. And finally, we talked about a couple of different recommendations related to training. And so these fell under two categories. The first one is really addressing the need for continuing education, especially on these new innovative technologies and approaches that evolve. And so this could be geared towards senior, mid-level, or junior cleanup personnel. But we also talked about the need to address the issue related to the loss of expertise from retirements. And so this is slightly different. It's not just transferring the information, but also the knowledge and the experience of these senior personnel to more junior personnel that are coming online. And so this could be achieved through mentoring or things like apprenticeships. And so we're always open to new ideas and suggestions on how we can implement some of these training tools. Next slide. And so we hope this gives you a good overview of what we discussed last week related to some of the challenges and needs, technology needs that some of the federal agencies are facing over the next decade. So now we're going to switch gears and talk about the opportunities for advancing technologies. And so Heather Henry is going to be talking about or providing an overview of FRT agency responses to the FRTR questionnaire regarding the advancement of innovation remediation technologies. And so since 2006, Dr. Heather Henry has been at the National Institutes of Environmental Health Sciences Superfund Research Program, SRP, where she leads SRP's Remediation and Detection Technology Small Business Research Grant Program. She directs a portfolio of bioremediation and materials science grants and acts as a program officer for the SRP Multidisciplinary Center grants. She serves on several working groups, including the Federal Remediation Technology Forum, the National Nanotechnology Initiative Water Sustainability, the NIH COVID-19 Wastewater Surveillance, NIEHS Emerging Contaminants, and NIEHS Disaster Research Response Initiatives. She received a BS in Biological Sciences from the University of Rochester, a PhD in Biology from the University of Cincinnati, and she also completed a Fulbright Postdoctoral Fellowship with the University of Melbourne, University of Adelaide, and Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization. And with that, I'd like to welcome Heather Henry.
Thank you, Tanya. Appreciate the introduction. Next slide. As Tanya mentioned, last week's meeting focused on senior leader responses to a questionnaire about grand challenges, technology needs, and research gaps. What I'm going to do now is provide a high-level summary of the responses that we received about advancing new technologies, such as barriers, recommendations, and promising technologies. And I will also share ideas we received for the FRTR in terms of a vision going forward. We did also poll the FRTR agencies for initiatives and programs, as well as resources that will be useful for the FRTR. And we got such an incredible response that we are still busily organizing that, and we'll post that with other meeting outcomes. But we would be delighted for our audience to respond to these same questions. So you can send your responses through the QA box. And I think Jean has just posted them for you to see. You can send it through the QA box or send us through this email by May 31st, if at all possible. And this will be helpful for us as we guide future directions of the FRTR. So next slide, please. And on behalf of the FRTR, a huge thank you to the FRTR agencies who provided input to these questions. So let's start with the barriers to advancing new technologies. Next slide. And a lot of these came up in the discussion that Tanya just provided, but what we're going to be talking here are the general themes that we received from the agencies, high-level review of the responses that we received. So several agencies identified that there are not many demonstration and verification opportunities for advancing new technologies, which makes it difficult for scale up from laboratory to field. There's also sometimes a disconnect in the technology development process. So a difficulty in matching a technology to sites and addressing specific site needs. There are also difficulties in testing new technologies at sites. Sometimes it's a regulatory constraint. Sometimes it's just reluctance to adopt new technologies. Often that reluctance may be due to the time commitment involved in providing access and support for trying out new technologies. Next slide. In terms of recommendations that would aid in advancing technologies for field readiness, several agencies mentioned the need for additional resources for advancing new technologies, such as pilot testing, verification strategies, et cetera. Agencies also saw the importance of source reduction technologies and encourage their continued development. Development of innovative approaches that are compatible with federal location-specific, applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements. It was also recommended that the FRTR continue its role in facilitating collaboration, communication, and information sharing among agencies, a lot of which Tanya just mentioned. And there were suggestions of platforms for information exchange, such as holding an annual workshop to discuss new technologies or utilizing social media to get input to resolve technical issues, also to provide direction in applying new technologies. Next slide. Among the new promising new technologies identified, we saw responses for passive treatment and mining influenced water, remote sensing for large scale, as well as application of robotics for monitoring. There's interest in new tools to interpret geology and chemistry data to build better conceptual site models. Also, a lot of promise in the use of artificial intelligence, machine learning. This helps guide remediation technologies and, again, analyzes data across multiple sites. There's also interest in utilizing promising approaches for source reduction. Next slide. As part of the survey, we also asked the senior leaders to think about future directions. This will be used to guide the FRTR steering committee going forward as we consider the input that we've received. So there's a lot of support for continuing sharing lessons learned, updates on innovative technologies, estimating costs across similar sites. This type of crosstalk is very helpful for all agencies. The cost comparisons are very informative, and they even help in the context of new technology development because it serves as a great benchmark for comparing with existing competing technologies. There's also support for engaging with outside researchers and technology developers to better communicate what are the unmet needs and opportunities for remediation technologies. Develop a framework to share progress of new technology application between the agencies. And just as important is to continue to be a resource for identifying subject matter expertise within the agencies. Identifying promising opportunities to leverage other ongoing initiatives and programs, identifying when there are implications to remediation practice through important initiatives such as climate change, environmental justice, emerging contaminants, for example. And then also there's a need to focus on optimizing the cost and timeframe of remediation practice, but doing so in a manner that is enhancing safety and is a net benefit to the environment, being cognizant of opportunities to improve the overall life cycle of a remediation effort. Next slide. And along those lines, we see a need for identifying promising, innovative solutions that will be resilient to the impacts of climate change and a proactive approach to emerging chemicals, accelerating scientific understanding and advancing characterization and remediation approaches. There's a continued role for FRTR to exchange methods to deal with sites that are particularly difficult to remediate. And lastly, a recommendation to engage with and identify training needs for current and next generation of remediation professionals. Next slide. So I hope this overview provided a sense of the feedback we received from the senior leaders in the survey. A lot of this was reflected in the presentation that Tanya just gave. So there's consistency, that's always good. Before we move on to hear from our panel of senior leaders, I would like to once again invite our audience to respond to these same questions through the Q&A box or send your responses to the email listed here. Thank you for your attention. And with that, I would like to introduce our moderator for the Advancing Technologies panel. Dr. Kent Glover has been involved in groundwater invasive zone remediation since the early 1980s. Currently, he is the Air Force subject matter expert for remediation systems and provides technical leadership in remedy selection, implementation, performance evaluation, and optimization. He also provides expertise in numerical modeling of contaminant fate and transport and remediation of non-aqueous phase liquids. Before coming to the Air Force in 2010, he was a principal scientist for several engineering firms providing consulting services to private sector and government clients. From 1976 to 1989, he served in the USGS as a hydrologist for groundwater contamination and water resources projects across the Western United States. He holds a PhD and MS in environmental science and engineering from Colorado School of Mines and a BS in watershed science from Colorado State University. So Kent, I will now hand it off to you to introduce the panel.
Thank you very much, Heather. Today, we've assembled a panel of senior technologists and leaders from member agencies of FRTR to continue our discussion of agency perspectives on how to advance promising remediation research and apply new technologies at field scale sites, or field site scales, I should say. So let's go to the next slide, please. Thank you. During the first part of our discussion, each panel will highlight program initiatives by their organization to advance technology and innovation in order to expedite and improve site cleanup. And then we'll be taking a short break. And in the second part of the discussion, we'll have a less formal question and answer session where today's attendees, you and the audience, will have an opportunity to participate in the dialogue. And Jean Ballant will tell us a bit more about that in a bit. You've heard it already a couple of times. Our panelists are listed on this slide, and I will introduce each of them in turn as they each provide a 5 to 7 minute sort of overview of their program. And so let's get started. Our first panelist is Dr. Heather Henry, who you just saw. I won't read through her little bio because you've already heard that, but I will note that I think she's the only Fulbright scholar on the panel list on the panel today. So, Heather, welcome back.
Well, thank you, Kent. It's an honor to be here today to talk about the Superfund research program capabilities and directions in advancing innovative remediation technologies. I'm filling in for Dr. William Sook, who's the director of our program. He actually gave a presentation last week detailing the SRP. So I will build on his presentation, focusing in on our remediation modeling and detection technology portfolio. But before I do that, I wanted to direct you to the diagram on the left here, which appeared in our SRP strategic plan from last summer. It shows the full breadth of the Superfund research program, so you can get a full sense of the program's overall capabilities. So our mandates under SARA legislation called for basic research and training program, including biomedical research, as well as environmental science and engineering. But realizing the importance of connecting this basic fundamental science to real-world application, our program includes experts in community engagement, research translation, and data science, ensuring that there is a lasting impact and that the impact is tailored to stakeholders and their community needs. Lastly, a major capability of our program are the trainees that come from the program, graduate and postdoctoral students who are trained in multidisciplinary approaches. And actually, many of them are making a difference as professionals in the environmental remediation world, as research academics, as part of engineering firms, and many have actually ended up in several of the FRTR agencies. Next slide, please. So just want to give a snapshot of the overall SRP research grant portfolio. We have multidisciplinary centers that cover all the areas of research that I just mentioned. We also have a new program combining bioremediation and material science for emerging contaminants and mixtures. And then we also have our SBIR program funding phase one, phase two grants, and some limited opportunities beyond phase two. Together, roughly half of our portfolio is monitoring, modeling, and remediation. I also wanted to mention that regardless of the mechanism, all of the projects do include either a research translation, a technology transfer, or commercialization plan. In fact, several of our grantees are working on projects partnering with federal FRTR federal agencies, as well as engineering firms, and maybe some of the engineering firms who are on the call today even. Next slide. SRP works through grant mechanisms, not contracts. So these are opportunities are released by NIH as a funding opportunity announcement. Therefore, the research is largely investigator initiated. But what I do want to tell you is that we certainly put an emphasis on sustainability. We're looking for green technologies, technologies especially practical for adoption by impacted communities, whether it's due to the ease of the use of the technology or being a more affordable approach. And climate change resilience is also another consideration. Among some of the promising technologies, omics approaches, machine learning, and nanotechnologies hold a lot of promise to really advance and disrupt the remediation and site assessment process. In terms of technology readiness level, we generally range between a TLR of 1 to 6. So advancing beyond those stages would typically occur through other mechanisms. But we certainly do have our success stories. As Dr. Sook presented last week, as is in a publication there from 2018, where we detail some of our success stories. So long story short, it's a long process from basic research to field implementation, but the impact is huge in terms of the cost savings. And so moving away from costly pump and treat approaches is always a good thing, which I think everyone will agree with. So next slide, please. In terms of barriers and challenges to technology development, the reality of the research enterprise is that basic research is very successful in generating important fundamental knowledge, but it does not always lead to application. But there are technologies that are ready to start moving into the field, and there are many starts and stops providing lessons learned, which help reshape the technology. But it's also important to have opportunities to test technologies in a field setting, and multiple field settings is actually even more ideal. So as mentioned in the previous presentation, finding the right site is difficult for technology developers. Both parties need to be willing. There's a time commitment. New technologies take several iterations to get it right. Takes a lot of patience. So needless to say, it's important that both parties' expectations are managed. Also mentioned in the prior presentation, there's limited funding for moving technologies from the field to into the field and commercialization. Next slide. So while there are barriers, there are opportunities. Perhaps there could be more strategic way to match technology developers with sites that are willing to or able to try out new approaches, or establishing more study sites for, let's say, round-robin testing. We think that interactions with stakeholders early on in the research process may be a good way to help transfer knowledge about the real gaps and needs in technologies. And possibly there might be better ways to leverage existing data and field experiences, particularly so that investigators avoid reinventing the wheel. And I think we all struggle with this, but how to sift through all the information that's out there? Is there an ideal way to package your information about ongoing work without overwhelming stakeholders? Something we did last fall was we developed a YouTube video shorts of each of our SBIR grants. So, you know, is something like this a good solution? Interested to know. And then next slide, please. Lastly, we see a huge opportunity in mentoring and training. Even if it is in the early development of the research project, cross-training of the younger generation to learn more about real-world sites and vice versa, and also for not-so-young generation to gain exposure to some of the younger generation and learn about some innovative data sharing, computational, and other advances that are second nature to these trainees. And as a program officer for a grant program, part of our job is to demystify the grant process for applicants. So maybe we need to work together to demystify the technology transfer process and figure out a roadmap for facilitating technology transfer and adaptation to ensure that these innovative technologies get a chance to be implemented in the real world. And next slide, please. With that, I would like to give special thanks to my colleagues at SRP, our director, Bill, my colleagues, Sarah, Danielle, Michelle, and Brittany. And I'd love for you to take a screenshot of this slide because there's a lot of opportunities here. We have research updates, upcoming workshops, webinars. There's an emerging contaminants, a request for information that's on the streets. And our SRP annual meeting will be in December. And we'd love for you to join us in Raleigh or virtually. And so, Kent, with that, I'll hand it back to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next panelist is Dr. Andrea Leeson. Andrea is the Deputy Director of the Environmental Environmental Restoration Program Manager of the Strategic Environmental Research and Development Program, also known as CERTIP, and the Environmental Security Technology Certification Program, also known as ESTCP. She's been with the programs since 2001, and prior to that, she was a research leader at Battelle Memorial Institute, where she conducted research related to in situ bioremediation and other innovative technologies for site remediation and industrial wastewater. She holds a doctoral degree in environmental engineering from Johns Hopkins University. And with that, I want to turn it over to you, Andrea, please.
Great. Thank you, Ken, and thank you to everyone for joining today. It has been a while since I presented to the FRTR, and I'm glad to be back. I do think this is a valuable work relationship between our two programs. So what I'd like to do before I jump into my presentation is describe our two companion programs here, because I don't really do it in the presentation, and I want to make sure that everyone who's on the call is familiar with who we are. CERTIP and ESTCP are two companion programs. They're environmental technology programs within the Department of Defense. CERTIP is a strategic environmental research and development program, and that's really our traditional R&D program. Much of the work is done in research laboratories, whether at universities, government level, et cetera. But it looks like a fairly traditional R&D program. ESTCP is the Environmental Security Technology Certification Program, and that is our demonstration and validation program. Now, CERTIP, as you can see from our logo, that's a partnership with the DOD, EPA, and Department of Energy. ESTCP is a DOD program, and the intent of ESTCP is that once research developed under CERTIP or under other agencies is mature and ready to be developed, this is what we do under ESTCP. We conduct demonstration and validation of these technologies, or sometimes it's not a single technology. It may be a body of knowledge that's been developed, and we validate, demonstrate and validate in the field when it's ready. Next slide. So what I'd like to do is give you a little overview here about how we do things in terms of what drives our research initiatives and ultimately what sort of technologies we're demonstrating in the field. Our first priority is the sustainment of our testing and training ranges, facilities, and operations. That's a tremendously broad category. And as you can see here, I've listed just a few of the issues that come under that, but that's everything from maritime sustainability to noise issues, our forward operating bases, and UXO ammunitions constituents. And that this area, the UXO ammunitions constituents, is probably the one area that really falls under the whole site cleanup issue that we deal with FRTR. As the munitions constituents, that falls under my program area of environmental restoration. And that's when the chemicals escape the munitions, they impact the water or the soils around them, and that's where we get involved. Next slide. And then we also are concerned with the reduction in current and future liability. Now, there is a piece of that program that addresses the pollution prevention and where we're trying to improve or replace hazardous materials or processes on our facilities. But then it also, a large component is dealing with contamination from past practices. That includes impacted groundwater, soils, and sediments. Our UXO liability falls under that. And then, of course, the whole issue of emerging chemicals of concern will fall under that area. And much of what we'll talk about today falls in this area of reducing this current liability. Next slide, please. So how we really develop what we'll address is we have these longer term strategic plans where we look at high priority requirements, and we look towards our technical committees to bring those requirements to us, but we also look to organizations such as the FRTR to bring up these issues as well, so we can make sure that we are addressing issues that are of importance to the user communities. And what we try to do is look to the future as much as possible. We certainly do not want to wait until there is a critical issue going on at our facilities before we jump into the research end, because as you know, the research can take a few years and then you'll go on to demonstration validation in the field. So it's important to stay ahead of what we know. And so that is always what we're trying to do, is trying to anticipate future issues. And so that means we're also, we want to be very responsive to evolving requirements, and in particular, such as these emerging chemicals of concern. And we do that in a number of ways, not only by listening to our technical committees, and I didn't describe what's on our technical committees, but what we have are representatives from the Air Force, Army, Navy, the EPA, the Department of Energy, as well as a number of other technical consultants who are familiar with issues going on in the field. Next slide, please. And so I wanted to show, you know, a really good example of some of what we've done with trying to jump on issues quickly. We're actually a pretty small office in terms of staffing and our processes that what that really means is we tend to be able to move a little quickly when something comes up. And so an example of this is PFAS. The year that the EPA published their provisional health advisories on PFAS and PFOA, we released a solicitation that same year, and that was to develop treatment options. And I'm not going to go in this slide in great detail, but this shows that from that piece, we were able to expand the research. And by the time that there was a tremendous amount of interest and concern about these chemicals, we already had several years worth of work accomplished. And I think that was very important, that again, looking to the future and trying to get ahead of what may be issues for us down the road. For those of you interested in PFAS, I will point you to this bottom link on the page. And this will take you to a similar, there it's being pointed out. This will take you to a similar page to this. It looks a little different, but it will have the same information. And from here, you can go to It'll be interactive. You can click on the different boxes, and what the boxes represent are groups of projects. The title shown here is just a brief snippet of what was covered in that year, and it will show you what's been funded over the years. And when you click on the box, it will give you a summary of what was being looked for, and then a summary of every single project that was selected that particular year. Certainly most of our effort has been within the last 3 or 4 years in this area. We're currently funding over $170 million worth of work, and that represents about 175 different projects. So it's a tremendous amount of effort. Next slide, please. And so I would like to leave you with what I consider the most critical piece of the work is ultimately that the research and results of our demonstrations have to reach our user community, and that is of critical importance to us. Without this translation of effort to the user communities, I think the value of the work is really diminished. It has to get out to the people and, you know, the sites that need the information. And so I think this is a place where the FRTR is uniquely positioned to help with this, and that, you know, as we interact with each other, we can make each other aware of the sort of work that's going on that would be of importance to others. And secondly, I think the FRTR also can help with, again, this issue of staying ahead of what's coming down the pike so that we can understand what kind of issues, not just necessarily a new chemical of concern, but a new issue that's going on at our facilities that we can get a jump on and develop the research and the demonstrations needed to address that. So Kent, I'll turn it back to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next panelist is, let me see, yes, Dr. Jeffrey Plumley. Jeff is the chief scientist of the U.S. Geological Survey, and he provides strategic scientific vision and counsel to the director and others in the USGS on science research priorities, activities, capabilities, and partnerships. Previously, he was the USGS Associate Director for Environmental Health, and he has over 30 years of research and science leadership experience with the USGS, including successful research collaborations with scientists from a broad range of disciplines. And he's a fellow of the Geological Society of America and has been very active in leadership with the GSA and the American Geophysical Union. He's an author, co-author of more than 140 papers and books, and has received several awards for meritorious and distinguished service from a number of organizations. He holds a BS in geology from the University of New Mexico, and his doctorate is in geochemistry from Harvard University. Jeff?
Great. Well, thanks, Kent. I appreciate it. And thanks to the organizing committee for inviting me to speak. And I also want to acknowledge the great help that Tanya Gallegos and Mary Kay Foley and Barbara Beacons provided in pulling together this presentation and the presentation last week. Next slide, please. So as I talked about last week in my presentation, the U.S. Geological Survey, or USGS, is a non-regulatory, non-advocacy science organization located within the Department of Interior. We do basic and applied science to support a wide range of remediation decisions, and we don't do regulations. We do the science that informs regulations. We do the science that informs policy. And we don't do typically much in the way of site remediation, but we do a lot of science that helps inform site remediation. And we have capabilities in laboratories, field studies spanning a full range of earth sciences, biological sciences, hydrology, and we do modeling, we do geospatial analysis, mapping, and a variety of geocomputations. Our expertise and that could be used or has been used or is currently working on environmental related topics is spread across our 5 different mission areas. For example, our energy and minerals mission area has, as you might suspect, a focus on abandoned mine sites and environmental issues associated with energy development. Also, what are the wastes from energy and mineral resource production? And an area that we've been looking at and are continuing to grow is mine waste as potential critical mineral resources. Environmental health programs look at a wide range of contaminants like perfluorinated compounds, drinking water compounds, emerging contaminants in drinking water and wastewater. Our water mission area has traditionally done a lot of work on a national basis looking at water quality. We also have regional capabilities, such as in our North Atlantic and Appalachian region on various capabilities. And we also do topic-specific things like karst. Karst terrains are geologic terrains that are very complex hydrologically. And our ecosystems mission area does a wide range of work on ecotoxicological and toxicological implications of contaminants and how those link to hydrology and geochemical processes. Next slide. So there's quite a bit of work that we do that relates to promising remediation research and applying new technologies. We do work all the way from site-specific up to both up to regional and then even national approaches. One of the things that we always appreciate doing is having is access to complex sites where our research and methods can be used to help interpret processes and inform remediation. We look at it from a source to receptor kind of approach, risk assessment approach. We use a lot of different advanced technologies, such as advanced sensors, remote sensing, unpiloted aerial systems, using machine learning, artificial intelligence to link and interpret diverse data sets. We're trying to develop a lot of new methodologies as well, looking at, for example, one of the things we've seen, particularly in the abandoned mine lands realm, where there are many different mine sites in a particular watershed, and how do you prioritize those for cleanup, and how do you understand the pre-mining baseline signatures, like I talked about last week. We can use these integrated climatic, topographic, geologic, geochemical, et cetera, models of watersheds so that we can actually model what the implications would be if you all of a sudden took out one source of contamination like a draining mine. We like to look at things in a One Health concept, which is the concept that the environment and the health of humans and the health of animals, both livestock and fish and wildlife, are all related. You see that in the diagram on the right. And then another aspect that we look at is the adoption of advanced geophysical site characterization, geological characterization, and monitoring technologies. Next slide, please. So there are a variety of things that we would like to see or we would like to continue to contribute to, say that three times fast, in terms of the future of FRTR. We've really valued our participation in FRTR and really enjoy and have learned a lot. So some things like having the member agencies understand how and where our science can be better prioritized. How can we exchange information? What can we do to gain access to these pilot study sites that are being remediated? And then what can we do to raise awareness of agency science needs? And one of the things that we've looked at, particularly in the mineral resources realm, how can we use our knowledge of geology and geochemistry and ecotoxicology to help prevent contamination before it occurs. And with that, thanks very much.
Thank you, Jeff. Our next panelist is Dr. Patricia Holohan. Patricia is the Director, Division of Decommissioning, Uranium Recovery and Waste Programs, Office of Nuclear Materials Safety and Safeguards at the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And she's been with NRC since 1991, has held several director-level positions as well as a variety of staff and management positions. Before joining NRC, Patricia worked as a radiation, a consulting biologist, and an assistant professor for University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio, the Armed Forces Radiobiology Research Institute. She holds her PhD in radiation biology from Colorado State University, a school I know well, and her BS and MS is from the University of Western Ontario. So Trish, I turn it over to you.
Thank you, Kent, and good afternoon or good morning or good evening where you are. It's my pleasure to see federal experts and managers from 11 different agencies working together in a roundtable to achieve a common goal of advancing the use of innovative technologies for cleanup of hazardous and radiological contamination and remediation of our environment from past activities. In fact, your mission is in harmony with our commonly known as DUWOP mission, Decommissioning Uranium Recovery and Waste Programs, which is protecting today, tomorrow, and cleanup of the past through decommissioning uranium recovery and waste management of radioactive materials. I'd like to thank Tom Nicholson, Bobby Abbey-Reed, George Alexander, and others for their work in pulling this presentation, as well as the one from NRC together last week together. So next slide. Our division and other divisions and offices at the NRC have a great interest in innovations in general. In particular, we're looking into advanced technologies that can be applied to all phases of decommissioning activities for nuclear power reactors and materials decommissioning sites. We don't just clean up reactors, but complex material sites, as well as uranium recovery sites. We work closely with our Office of Nuclear Regulatory Research in particular, who you heard from last week. For example, advanced technologies would be needed during the transitioning decommissioning phase from operation to decommissioning, such as dismantling and remote handling of components during the actual decommissioning involving characterization and cleanup of residual radioactivity in soil, subsurface, and groundwater, and during the process of license termination involving final status survey and demonstration of regulatory compliance for safety and environmental protection. Currently, we are keenly interested in enhanced and efficient technologies for characterization and cleanup of soils and subsurface media at reactor decommissioning sites, as well as materials and uranium recovery sites for demonstration of regulatory compliance. We're hosting a public workshop on July 14th and 15th to discuss innovative approaches to characterize and survey subsurface media. And we're extending an invitation to all our FRTR experts to participate. More information is available on our public website. And also it was going to be posted in the intermission session. Next slide, please. A vivid example of NRC's interest in advanced technology is its application to monitoring, characterization, and survey for subsurface at the in-situ uranium recovery sites for demonstration of long-term sustainability of acceptable level of radioactivity in subsurface throughout the performance period. Another important ongoing aspect at the NRC is the integration of innovative approaches and methods to support the concept of B-Risk Smart, which involves integrating risk insights into the NRC decision through being clear about the problem, spotting the risk, example, what can go wrong, consequence, and how likely to occur, managing the risk, realizing the results, and teaching of lessons learned. Therefore, we recommend that FRTR activities include exchange of information about applications of technologies for cleanup and remediation and transfer of knowledge about lessons learned. In other words, case studies to obtain real-world knowledge of accomplished site remediation should be an important function of FRTR. Next slide, please. The most conspicuous challenges we face may be other agencies as well, include knowledge transfer of innovative technologies to the remediation community and regulators, accessibility to new technologies and their cost efficiencies, and we've heard that in a number of the talks so far, coordination of regulatory updates, guidance, and good practices for robotic surveillance and application of new technologies, awareness of federally funded academic and research institutions of new and innovative remediation technologies and their application, and transitioning of advanced technologies from laboratory pilot scale to actual field implementation. Next slide, please. We have several suggestions to FRTR to include enhanced communication and technical exchanges at FRTR meetings, and we've heard that multiple times as well. A program to test and evaluate innovative technologies from transitioning from experimental pilot scale to field scale applications. To initiate discussions on regulatory updates, guidance, and good practices to incorporate new and innovative technologies. More frequent virtual workshops to explain and demonstrate advanced technologies and their transitioning to field implementation. And finally, coordination with academic and research institutions to showcase new and innovative remediation technologies funded by federal agencies. And the next slide. In conclusion, we at the NRC appreciate the great collaborative work of the FRTR to date. We endorse focusing on innovative technologies for remediation of radiological contamination, and we anticipate further collaboration on innovation, technology transfer, and risk assessment for decommissioning and environmental assessments and sharing of lessons learned. With that, I'll turn it back to you, Kent.
Thank you, Trish. Our next panelist is Mark Gilbertson. Mark is the Associate Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for Regulatory and Policy Affairs in the Office of Environmental Management at the U.S. Department of Energy. The EM office provides technical and policy support in the planning and field execution of EM waste and minerals disposition, soil and groundwater remediation, and activation and decommissioning of EM facilities. He has been with EM for more than 25 years and has served in a number of senior leadership positions. Prior to EM, Mark held positions throughout other Department of Energy offices and spent 4 years at the EPA and as an engineering consultant before that. Mark holds a BS in chemical engineering from the University of Wisconsin and an executive certificate in management and leadership from Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And Mark, I'll pass the baton to you now.
Thank you, Kent. I think I get probably the prize for one of the most complicated acronyms for titles. We like our acronyms in the federal government, but So I want to first thank Paul Beam and Kurt Gers for their assistance in preparation of materials for this discussion. As I mentioned at the last session, EM is one of the largest cleanup programs in the world. We have over $70 billion worth of work that we need to do within the next 10 years, and we won't be done in that time frame. And we're one of the largest liabilities in the federal government. With that said, the work that the Federal Remediation Technology Roundtable does is really important to us. The more we can innovate, the faster we can do things, the more we can bring science into decision making, the better off we'll be in the long run with regard to our program for and reduce risk to the environment and public, and to do it in an efficient manner for taxpayers. With that, I just chose a few things. We chose a few things to highlight, with regard to some of the program initiatives. Obviously, it would be hard to cover everything we're doing in this kind of time frame, but I wanted to highlight a few things to get people thinking a little out of their box with regard to some of the things potentially we might do going into the future. Next slide. So You know, we're working with minority-serving institutions and universities like FIU down in Florida, which is one of the largest Hispanic universities in the country, to explore how we bring a next generation into our workforce to tackle our kind of issues. And whether it's through interaction with them and supporting research or fellowships with regard to those programs, I think some of the things that we need to think about as we go forward is how do we speak to the next generation of technologists and scientists that are doing our work, and recognize the fact that social media platforms play a large role in the world of young professionals. We're exploring a little bit in our partnership with a non-for-profit who does symposiums. Some of you may have attended the Waste Management Symposium historically. And the young people are very integrated into the activities within that kind of meeting and forum. And so I think that that's going to be one of our challenges as we go into the future, how we translate technical issues and direction in ways that speak to younger generation, young professionals, and also our social media platform friendly. And so that's a challenge for us as we move forward that we're trying to tackle a little bit. Workers are important to us. Another example I'll get to kind of spur people's thoughts are, so the workforce is important. We have over 30,000 contractors across the country that perform our cleanup mission, our cleanup work. One thing that I think we need to think about, and we're just tackling it in a little way, we work with the university community and NASA to explore a little bit about, so what does the work environment look like for a cleanup worker going into the future? You know, and so in some cases we're exploring, you know, wearable robotics where people have to do repetitive kind of motions, sampling and or verifying radiologic characteristics of particular facilities and areas before we do the cleanup of those particular areas. But I think that if you kind of let your mind expand a little bit more, you could see where this is a potential area going into the future where, you know, we all might learn and translate into some new directions for us to go in the remediation area. Next slide. So that also highlights a little bit of the importance for us to work across federal agencies to tackle these kind of issues and to leverage each other's activities. I think that one of the things that I've been really encouraged from this group and from the discussions over the last two sessions is the work that's being done on emerging contaminants like PFAS. I think we have to, as a community, be together, work together, have one voice with regard to the nature of the risks associated with PFAS, and really share approaches, technical approaches, communication approaches, so that we get consistency to build confidence with regard to the public, with regard to tackling these kind of issues. If we all go it alone, I don't believe that we're going to be as successful as if we work together as a community to tackle these kind of issues. And that's just one example, but I think you heard from the others that there are numerous examples of situations where we're facing remediation at complex sites, or we're facing remediation of sites where the current remedy isn't as effective and we're kind of in the mode where we have to demonstrate, you know, that monitored natural attenuation is the direction that we need to be with things. the way that we communicate it, and if we can communicate it across agencies in a consistent manner, I think that will be more powerful. And so the importance of this particular group, I think, is really essential and critical as we go forward into the future to tackle these issues. Next slide. So the future, just a couple of suggestions that we recommend, and I know it may be out of the comfort zone for some of us as we kind of move forward with things, but it may be a way to draw in new people, new blood to the community, is to think about how we expand our social media kind of outlets and products to speak to new members and a newer generation with regard to ideas. How might we do that? You know, it wasn't so long ago we felt we had to meet in person to transfer knowledge and information. And now look at us, we're doing a webinar and lots of webinars driven by, you know, the COVID situation, but nonetheless, you know, something that we need to learn from going into the future. And I think the new generations are much more comfortable with those kind of media. And so we need to learn from them and work with them to share lessons learned and move into the future. So improvement of coordination and communication, which has been talked about before, but maybe in a little bit different light. You know, not so much the technical aspects of things, but thinking about how we say our messages, how we share things, what platforms we share them on. You know, might it be different than our traditional websites that we use? Does that speak to people? Might we do targeted webinars where we're targeting students, where we're targeting university folks, where we bring in students that are doing research for our various programs to try and advance the thinking with regard to our field. So they're just a few of our ideas that I wanted to share with you. But thank you for this opportunity. And I do believe this group is very important and applaud the 30 years of effort that that people have dedicated to this important endeavor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Our next panelist is Dr. Charles Maurice. Charles is an Associate National Program Director with the U.S. EPA Sustainability and Healthy Communities National Research Program, and which focuses primarily on contaminated sites and waste management topics. Previously, he was the Superfund and Technology Liaison to EPA Region 5 out of Chicago for 16 years, and a project manager, senior ecologist, and ecological risk assessor. Charles holds a PhD in environmental plant biology from the University of Illinois, and MS from Bowling Green State University, and a BS from Eastern Illinois University. Charles, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Ken. And good afternoon, everyone, or good morning, wherever you may be. I want to start off by thanking FRTR for inviting me to speak about some of the advances in innovative remediation technologies that the Environmental Protection Agency is accomplishing through the Sustainable and Healthy Communities Research Program. Our program supports EPA land, mining, and waste-based programs such as Superfund, RECRA, brownfields, and underground storage tanks. Within the contaminated sites topic, we have research areas that address site characterization and remediation, solvent vapor intrusion, and leaking underground storage tanks, and we have a vibrant technical support effort, which connects our researchers and the EPA and state practitioners in the EPA regions and program offices. Okay, next slide, please. In the short amount of time I have, I'm going to focus on some remediation technology advances for contaminated groundwater remediation research, namely groundwater remediation for arsenic, using rare earth elements as tracers for groundwater remediation, using biochar to absorb metals in mine-influenced waters, and managing back diffusion in contaminated groundwater plumes. The next slide, please. An example of interagency collaboration to advance groundwater remediation technology is provided by a Superfund site in New Jersey, which had a recalcitrant arsenic plume in iron-rich groundwater. A costly pump and treat system had been operated for 10 years and was determined to be unlikely to restore the aquifer within a reasonable period of time. In collaboration effort between the EPA Office of Research and Development and EPA Region 2 out of New York City and the Army Corps of Engineers, a large-scale pilot air sparge system was developed using a novel approach that combined bench scale tests, geochemical modeling, and groundwater and soil characterization. The researchers identified key processes and parameters controlling arsenic immobilization that they were able to exploit to create conditions for a sustained air sparge system. The successful pilot was used to optimize the design of a full-scale system and provide insights for designing air sparge systems at other sites with arsenic-impacted iron-rich groundwater having variable redox conditions. The details of this collaborative effort can be found in the 59-page EPA report listed on the slide there in the first bullet. Next slide, please. As was mentioned several times last week and again today, long-term remedy performance needs to be better evaluated. I think this is something that most of us agree upon. This next case displays a technological advance using rare earth elements as natural tracers to evaluate long-term effectiveness of groundwater remediation remedies. Such types of new geochemical methodologies are needed to improve field monitoring to find out how well an in-situ remedy performs over the long term, or even why it may have failed. More details on this can be found in the 2021 Environmental Science and Technology article indicated on this slide. Next slide, please. Use of customized biochar substrates to polish mine-influenced water in aerobic bioreactors represents yet another advance in remediation technology. Because
Chuck, I'm afraid you muted. There you go. I think you're unmuted now.
Was I muted the whole time?
No, just in the last second. So you can carry on. We heard you just start to talk about the biochar.
I'll back up a little bit.
Chuck, it looks like you were remuted again. Hang on. If you can try to unmute. There we go.
I'm not touching.
Oh.
I see on my computer that the mute sign keeps on popping up.
Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to pop a button here, and then I'm going to ask all of my panelists and co-hosts in the background to be sure that their hands are up in the air and away from the keyboard to make sure that nobody is inadvertently trying to help Charles. So Charles, it looks like you're unmuted right now, and if you want to try to speak, let's see if we've solved that problem for you.
Okay. Well, as I was saying, use of the biochar that's customized to polish mine-influenced water in anaerobic bioreactors represents another advance in remediation technology. Because mine influence water typically is very acidic and contains very high metals and sulfates concentrations. Conventional anaerobic bioreactors treatment frequently provides insufficient water amelioration for final discharge. However, using customized biochar made from combinations of carbonaceous materials such as lignin, manure, or chitin, and adding it to the bioreactor systems has been shown to successfully meet state benchmarks, even for more difficult metals to remove, such as zinc and manganese. Next slide, please. You seem to be holding now, Jean, so that's a good sign. Lastly, some of the EPA researchers are advancing management of back diffusion to address contaminated groundwater plume persistence. They conducted a critical review of peer-reviewed literature addressing treatment options to combat back diffusion. They classified back diffusion management options into four categories depicted on the slide, with cost, difficulty, and performance generally increasing from left to right, and published their findings in the 2021 Groundwater Monitoring and Remediation Review article, also indicated on the slide. Currently, they are developing case studies based on actual sites to advance practical back diffusion best practices. Next slide, please. This is my last slide. I would have provided the full references to some of the EPA remediation technology advancements work I just discussed. And I also want to extend a special thanks to Dr. Richard Wilkin of our Ada, Oklahoma lab, who is one of our lead groundwater researchers at EPA and who provided much of the content for my presentation. Thank you for your attention. And now back to Dr. Glover.
Thank you, Charles. Our next panelist is Gunardi Coughlin. Gunardi is an environmental engineer at the Environmental Restoration Division of the Naval Facilities Engineering Command at headquarters, where she leads initiatives to promote innovative technologies and remedy optimization within the Navy's Environmental Restoration Program. Her experience includes management, design, and implementation of remediation activities under CERCLA, and she received her BS in chemical engineering from, and I know, Gunardi, I'm going to butcher this, Sriwijaya, right?
Sriwijaya.
Ah, there we go. I'm glad you said it. In Indonesia, and her MS degree is in environmental science and engineering from Colorado School of Mines, which I'm better at saying and know well. Yeah. she's a registered professional engineer in the state of Virginia. And Gunardi, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. And certainly it's my pleasure and honor to be part of 30 years celebration of FRTR. I remember the first time I came into the environmental restoration. I use technology metrics that FRTR have, and it's quite a lifeline for me. So it's certainly an honor for me to be part of it. So anyway, I am going to touch base on NAFAC capabilities and direction to advance innovative remediation technology. And for those who aren't familiar with NAFAC and what we do, NAFAC headquarters team, we execute and manage the environmental restoration program for all the Department of the Navy sites as part of our historical operation under CERCLA. And the NAFAC headquarters both manage the active installation site. We have about 4,500 sites under active installation and also BRAC. So talking about the end users of technologies, we are it, basically. So next slide. So as part of the leadership panel last week, the focus areas basically that provide us with challenges for our programs are emerging chemicals of concerns, similar to everyone else, and also emerging requirements, in this case, PFAS, low-level radiological, 1,4 dioxane, vapor intrusion, and lead. And then the second category will be complex sites. In this case, the lingering groundwater plumes where we have operated remediation system, active remediation system, mostly pump and treat for decades. And we're not anywhere near reaching our goals. And in the complex site categories, we also have underwater munition sites. And forget about the low risk sites, because we have hundreds of low risk sites, in particular petroleum sites, where we keep like extracting products, and we haven't seen any strategy to bring these sites to closure yet, as of yet. And under this category, also hundreds of landfill sites where we put in place caps, and we keep performing monitoring for decades and decades. So with these focus areas, what are we doing exactly in our program to somewhat identify, promote, and also implement innovative technologies? Well, we have a combination of paths, basically, integrated efforts, started with our own communities. And so everyone is familiar, the Department of the Navy Environmental Restoration Program communities, those as part of the community members, we have our leadership managers, remedial project managers, who's really like familiar with the site characteristic, with the contamination, and with the site requirements. Also subject matter experts from our two technology excellence, which is XWIC and NAFAC Atlantic, and also SMEs. But also very important are our community of contractors, because contractors are the one with the day-to-day knowledge and involvement at the site. So we integrate the need and identification of technology innovation through our community. We put it through our execution, have RPMs, SMEs, contractors through work groups, which I'm going to touch base a little bit later, to work together to identify what the site needs and what's available out there throughout the DOD effort, outside DOD, such as EPA, ITRC, SURGEP ESTCP, and our own strategic investment, and also our own quote-unquote R&D program. So I mentioned we have a strategic program investment for portfolio-wide themes. An example of portfolio-wide themes that we put investment in is PFAS treatment for IDW, for example. And then strengthening case for M&A. We have many sites with M&A approach, but then we need to figure out what's the transition point for those sites. And then most of our sites are located on the shore because we're like Navy installation. So our groundwater, contaminated groundwater plumes, majority of them actually discharge into surface water. So how do we actually handle those? So that's also a portfolio-wide theme that we're invested. Closure strategy on petroleum sites. And then lastly, sorting technology for commingled munition and low-level radiological contaminants. So we leverage NASD. NASD is Naval Environmental Sustainability Development 2 Integration Program. The size of the program is about $5 to $6 million annually, with the mission of demonstrating, validating, integrating innovative technologies, processes, materials to minimize operational environmental risk, constraints, and costs, while at the same time supporting the fleet readiness. Lastly, we also leverage DOD, such as SARDEP and ESCCB. So Ken and I actually, along with Mark Rothes, Andy Anders, and then our colleague from DLA, we stood up tri-surface remediation optimization work group a couple of years ago, and it's a little bit dormant right now, but I think that's also a good forum to revive. Next slide, please.
And Artie, just to give you a quick time check, we just have a few moments left.
Okay. So this is an optimization technology work group. We basically collaborate in here with the focus of having balanced performance, sustainability, and schedule and cost toward goals. So this is where we incorporate the potential climate change impact, and we conduct that as part of long-term efficiency evaluation of a remedy. Technology and knowledge transfer, that is an important theme that has been echoed throughout this seminar. And I'm gonna show you our strategic investment through NASD and portfolio and strategic investment. So as you can see, the proportion of our investments are pretty much on the same proportion for both strategic investment and NASD. Next slide, please. So this is an example of one of our strategic investment in low risk petroleum sites. We categorize our petroleum sites and come up with recommendation on how to move that forward. And we're definitely would like to work with all the stakeholders and the regulators to somewhat implement what we find out in this strategic investment. Next slide. One thing that's important, how we overcome barrier to innovation, is improving the pace. Andrea mentioned that it takes quite a few years to have a technology from the proof of concept to field-ready validation. And as you can see, SIRDEP and ESTCP typically take 3 to 4 years, NASD 2 to 4 years, and we stagger this. So we pick the one that's already like ready for full-scale validation, either from SIRDEP, ESCCP, or from NASD, and then expedite those in the in our program strategic investment. So where FRTR can provide value, we think that FRTR, Dr. Holohan mentioned earlier, that 11 agencies are collaborating in FRTR. So I think that would be a perfect forum to have a technology clearinghouse where FRTR, every member of FRTR can actually contribute what they've implemented, what the lesson learned, how much the costs and the performance, and then somewhat pool everything and then have FRTR maintain the clearinghouse. And therefore, we all can reap the benefit and take advantage of that. Next slide. These are the list of our strategic investment project coming up in FY21. As you can see, from the previous strategic investment, we were able to actually develop this mobile treatment for PFAS IDW treatment. So that will be implemented in a couple of our installations. So that's the first project. And then vapor intrusion mitigation. And we've been so far using like whole building mitigation. And we would like to see if we can somewhat strategically on site with preferential pathway to just isolate and then have a smaller scale mitigation. Petroleum site I mentioned earlier, and then also strengthening the line of evidence for monitor natural attenuation. So with that, I would turn it back to Ken.
Thank you very much, Gennady. Our final panelist is Jeffrey Davis, and I have the pleasure of working with the man on a daily basis. He's the program manager and remediation engineer specialist for the Air Force Civil Engineer Center. FCEC's BAA program demonstrates and validates innovative, sustainable, and cost-effective technologies and methodologies leading to more efficient and effective remediation of sites across the Air Force. He has 28 years of federal service, 10 years as a researcher with the Army Corps of Engineers, 8 with the Army Environmental Command as a program manager, and in about 2016, he joined AFCAC. He holds a BS from the University of Texas and an MS and PhD in environmental engineering from the University of Houston. Did a bit of postdoc work at Johns Hopkins. So, Jeff, it's all yours.
Thank you, Kent. Next slide. What is the Air Force Restoration BAA? Basically, it's been modeled very similar to and mimics, for the most part, Andrea's program at the ESTCP. Our job is a little different. One thing that we really like to get emphasize is how do we overcome that valley of death issue. So we've kind of implemented some policies and guidance on how to move forward in pushing these out so they'll get immortalized and remain at the installation and basically continue on with the base contractor continuing these technologies as they move forward. Our program really has got two focus areas. One is what we call the legacy issue, high resolution site characterization. We realize we have several sites that are out there. It's a mature program. Several sites basically are recalcitrant ones. They either have competing contaminants or difficult geologies to deal with. So, and essentially we've remediated them enough that the conceptual site model has changed significantly. So we found out we were using a lot of high resolution site characterization. So we started developing a focus area so we could evaluate some of these technologies that are out there and put them together. And I'll talk about one project that we are finalizing right now that we're very happy with. And the other is, yes, we PFAS remediation. I like to tell people we do more than just PFAS remediation. We have our legacy issues that we're dealing with. Next slide. What's the process? First of all, I'd like to break a little news here. The BAA is finally out on the street. The dates listed on this are very aspirational this year, but the BAA announcement was published at Beta Sam on Friday. So those that are interested can go there and take a look at the statement of needs. But essentially the way our process works is we go to our practitioners at the bases and our program management division and ask them what their issues or problem is. This helps us out because it really, they have a lot more buy-in into any of the projects that get awarded because they've asked for these projects. And like I mentioned, it's very similar to the ESTCP process. And the other thing we're doing is at the phase one proposal stage, if a lot of projects may come in without a base that they are partnering with. And we will try to get their CZO, which is the base level folks, and CER, which is the program management people, and pair them up with these proposals so that first of all, we get the folks at the base, you know, behind the project and wanting it to go forward, even beyond them asking for some of these. And CZR, who are the programmers, that they will realize that that this is going on and they could program for future years or any modifications to contracting and that may be done once this project is over and we keep it going forward past the project itself. Our aspirational goal is to award in July and August, and probably not going to make that, but we will make it by the end of September. Next slide. Two statement of needs are out there. First one is PFAS, and it's in the statement of need. If you're interested in that, you can look that up at Beta Sam. And the other is the site characterization specifically for an installation and one site at Columbus Air Force Base. Next slide. I'd like to talk about basically two of these projects. We have several PFAS remediation projects and a couple of legacy issue ones. First of all, the legacy issue one, the high resolution site characterization, guidance and demonstration. We noticed we had a lot of these projects that were using this and the technology was changing rapidly and new systems coming online, HPT, Waterloo, DIALIF, MIP. There's numerous of those. So we commissioned someone to basically put together a compendium and guidance on how to do high resolution site characterization. And CDM Smith did that for us. And also they developed a tool where you can go in, basically put your DQOs that you require, and it will generate a list of the tools that are available. And basically the operator of that then goes through and basically does a sanity check to make sure it makes sense to use that. It may be that it spits out two tools that do the same thing, so you can throw one away. And we demonstrated that technology at an Air Force installation and provided a lot of useful information for redeveloping their conceptual site model. The other one is the third one on the PFAS, their enhanced contact electrical discharge plasma reactor for destruction of PFAS compounds. This is a project that we had with Clarkson. It was to handle a very specific Air Force problem, and that was how do we get rid of our IDW? We had a lot of SIs completing, and we didn't know how to get rid of the PFAS contaminated waters. It was sitting in drums for quite a while. So we thought we needed to develop a technology or process to destroy the PFAS in this IDW for especially the upcoming RIs. And this project right now has been transitioned to our operations directorate down at Tyndall under the NDCEE program. Next slide, that may be it. Yep, and I'll pass it back to Kent.
Thanks, Jeff. I want to thank our panelists for their presentation today. And to keep this thing short and close to on time, I'll now pass the baton back to Jean Ballant.
Well, thank you very much, Kent. All right, so we are about to go ahead and turn it over to you, and I'll keep working to add our panelists in on the screen.
Very good. Thank you, Jean. A few opening remarks. The presentations today by Drs. Gallegos and Henry, as well as all the short presentations by the panelists, have highlighted our current challenges, needs, barriers, initiatives for advancing technology and new science. And broadly speaking, it seems that the topics fall into two broad categories. One is the specific advances in science and engineering that could lead to more effective site characterization and cleanup. And the second category of topics is more along the lines of resources and mechanisms for information exchange and interagency collaboration to foster innovation and advance remediation science and technology for full-scale use. So topics in the first category are going to help FRTR identify future meeting objectives, web content, and other the focus of other tech transfer activities. But today I want to focus our panel discussion on the second category, resources and mechanisms for information exchange category. So, and I want to just to get the discussion started, I want to start by addressing the Valley of Death issue that a couple of folks raised last week and again here today, with the hope that it will prompt some interesting ideas and questions from our panel, but also from our audience attending the webinar today. And I expect that we'll transition the discussion then to a broader discussion of technology transfer, information exchange, and specifically how FRTR might foster that interagency collaboration. So let's start with the Valley of Death question. Much of what we discussed in FRTR meetings focuses on recent progress and case studies related to development, testing, and evaluation of innovative science, technology, and technical approaches for site cleanup. And this effort is intended to help a much larger group of remediation professionals in our agencies that are tasked with meeting specific site-specific cleanup goals and closing sites. And this larger group of quote unquote end users is really not adverse to innovative science and technology. However, they need to know that the risks of deploying limited funds and resources for innovation will provide some reasonable and demonstrable benefit when applied to full-scale cleanup activities at their sites. Really, advancing science and technology is secondary. They're more interested in acceptable, practical applications, not science projects. So with that preamble, I'm going to ask a couple of our panelists. First, I'll start maybe with Gunardi from NAVFAC and then follow up with Mark Gilbertson from the DOE. How's your agency attempting to address this end user challenge of applying new remediation technologies, and what successes have these initiatives had? And I want to start, Gunardi, if you start the discussion, and then Mark, I'm curious to hear what you have to say. I know DOE has close relationships with a lot of national labs, and I'd like to hear a bit about that. So Gunardi?
Thank you. I just would like to let everyone know that I have two SMEs with me, Arun Gavaskar from XWIC and Mike Singletary from NAVFAC Southeast. And they're both very familiar with technologies and their application for our program. However, the first thing is, as I mentioned, the pace of transitioning of technologies is very critical. Granted that each technology needs to go through thorough proof of concept, demonstration, and validation before they are ready for field scale application. However, our needs is right now. So as I mentioned in my presentation earlier, we have a staggered approach, basically. So we leverage of what CERDAP ESTCB provide us, what EPA provide us, DOE, and the ITRC. And then from there, we select technologies that meet our needs, Department of the Navy's needs, and then we can either put it through NESD program, or we can put it into our strategic investment. And the strategic investment has been proven to somewhat accelerate the pace of transitioning between the validation, it shortened the validation timeframe. And we were able to somewhat address like a specific focus area. Success examples are, I mentioned earlier, we are able to develop a mobile treatment from small scale, medium scale, and large scale for treating PFAS IDW generated at our site. And in fact, we're going to try those at few sites. And with measurable outcomes where we can actually dispose the treated water to a non-HAZ facility. The second success example is the petroleum sites, the low-risk petroleum site. We're able to somewhat categorize our petroleum sites and then chart the path forward for each type, and we're actually going to walk the process and use the process as at two sites, and hopefully we can work with the regulators to close the sites. So I think knowledge and lesson learned sharing is also very important, and I hope FRTR can somewhat meet that requirement. Ken.
Thank you, Gennady. Mark, you have any thoughts on this question of the Valley of Death and how in your agency you're trying to demonstrate to end users the utility and value of new innovations?
So I think that, transparency to problem set is really important. And some of our liabilities are so large that we can do a technology pull into that particular environment to help reduce costs and risks associated with it. So, for those of you that have been around for a long time, I mean, we had worked with you guys, the whole community, decades ago to do bake-offs for various technologies at sites to deal with organics, steam apples, and other kind of things. We're a little bit more focused because we're down to a few sites, but some of those problems that we have are so large that we're willing to invest money to pull technologies in to potentially address that. And we're also willing to support development of research and develop technology with the national labs to try and explore new advances. The examples, I think some of the things that we have to look at going into the future is we know enough about a contaminant so that we can sorb the material in a barrier, whether that's injected into the subsurface or not. Maybe we need to explore, doing that and then applying remediation monitoring technologies to demonstrate that the technology works. And so I guess it's so big with some problems that we can afford to experiment a little bit because it's such large timeframes, but it's a contact sport. I'll stop there. That's something we could talk about for hours.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm hearing that it's a conscious effort at the national level, really, to program substantial funds into innovative technologies.
Well, and the national laboratories, for those of you that are familiar with it, have lab-directed research programs where they can focus dollars, you know, on the cutting edge kind of innovative approaches to tackling things depending on the science. And so we have literally hundreds of millions of dollars that the labs can afford to invest in some of those things, but you got to make your need known so they can apply the cutting edge science to it, what might be coming down the pike.
Okay. Yeah. That's a good point to end on, actually, just that very point. I'd like to move on and flip to the other end of the pipeline, so to speak, the technology pipeline, and ask Heather Henry and Jeff Plumley to weigh in on what they see as the issues and challenges, the Valley of Death issues that they are facing from their perspective in addressing this need for development of full-scale application of innovative techniques and so on. Heather?
Well, I think, you know, to a certain extent, it's a mission boundary for us. We are a basic research and training program. So, you know, certainly we want to maintain that fundamental science focus. That's very important to us. And, you know, let's face it, we need to know how the technology works when it does get applied in the field. So that is, you know, always going to be our focus. We do participate in the Small Business Innovative Research Program. There are lots of examples where technologies have come from academic labs. Some of them, even a part of our program, have transitioned into either a phase one or a phase two SBIR. And that gets an investigator, you know, approximately to the level where they are ready for upscaling and pilot testing, I would even say. But in terms of large field scale applications and the iterative approach, you know, maybe they can try it at one site, but not multiple sites. And so it just extends beyond what, you know, our program is able to support. I think also and I mentioned it in the presentation, but just the opportunity to maybe have a roadmap just to, for an investigator to know about the programs like Mark was talking about at DOE and know who to contact and, you know, establish a network along those lines and something like that, I think would be helpful. So I'll pass it off to Jeff now. Thank you.
Go right ahead, Jeff. Jeff Plumley.
Yep, I was on mute.
There you go.
Now off mute. I just wanted to stress that USGS is not an engineering organization. So we act, again, we don't really do active remediation design. But one place where we can help and have helped at a number of sites that are under remediation is that we can apply our knowledge of site hydrology, geology, geochemical processes, natural attenuation mechanisms, and things like that to actually get a better idea of whether a proposed remediation action might work and what we can bring to the table to help understand is something more likely to succeed or not based on our knowledge of all of those different aspects of the site and the processes that are controlling contaminants in the site. But in terms of developing specific engineering methods, that's not our bailiwick.
Yeah, well, you know, we have to base our technologies on our science too, you know. So
that's, yep.
Yeah, exactly. Let's move on then. I'm curious, you know, because our goal here in this meeting is really to chart a path forward for FRTR in the coming years. And so are there specific activities that FRTR can undertake to leverage agency successes? We've all had some successes at various stages in addressing this Valley of Death issue. And And so is there some, what's the specific activities that FRTR might undertake, and have a little discussion about that, and to leverage your agency's successes and also to perhaps help your agency out in addressing their limitations in creating this smooth pipeline from R&D to full-scale broad commercialization. So maybe I'll start with Andrea, because I'd just like to hear what you have to think, what your thoughts are about the role of FRTR in assisting this.
Yeah, I'm going to back up just a little bit too, is that, you know, I want to make the point that ESTCP was created to address that valley of death issue. It is a demonstration validation program, because it's extremely difficult for a technology to come out of the R&D phase and then be expected to go to a commercial phase. That's very unlikely to happen. And so ESTCP is geared to serve that purpose. From there, though, there truly is that other gap, which is where I see the FRTR as being able to play a good role, is that, you know, you almost need a champion of not even just a specific technology, but of the program of the ESTCP and the work that's being done to, you know, put forth the technology to your agency or to the people who work with you to say, you know, the stuff coming out of this program is probably worth your time to let it be demonstrated at your site. And we've worked, you know, very closely with Gnarty over the years and have had a lot of demonstrations that have occurred at Navy sites. And I think a big part of it is that because Gnarty and other people in the Navy serve as that liaison for us to say to the site managers to say, this is worth your time to do this. And that makes a big difference in us being able, you know, trying to contact site managers directly. And I think the FRTR is comprised of a lot of these liaisons who could be there to, you know, kind of get the word out to advance new technologies into their agencies and into the consultants that work for their agencies.
Okay, thank you. Charles Maurice, so EPA, do you have any thoughts on specific things FRTR can do?
Yeah, I guess I'm feeding off of Heather and Jeff and Andrea. You know, I think education and training is very important, getting people to understand the technologies and the circumstances that the different technologies work best at, or are mediocre at, or just really don't help out. You know, and I think, you know, within EPA, certainly we, you know, in the waste and land programs, we have Superfund. It has extensive training for the RPMs to keep them abreast of the different developments that are going on, not only in technologies, but in risk assessment and community engagement, what have you. But the better educated and knowledgeable your frontline people are, you know, the project managers that are running these sites that need the technologies and the different services, the better educated they are, and up to date, I think the better appreciation for that and knowledge of the different technologies. And so that's one angle that has worked well. Another angle, which I referred to in my comments earlier, is that we have a very vibrant, robust technical support program. And that really gives us advantages on things, not benefits, that benefits that from not only of the project managers and the people in the field getting the regulatory sphere, getting that the expert assistance that they need, but there's also that networking and communication and interlocking, which then the researchers also are gaining information and knowledge and perspective as to what the real world problems are. And so you get those connections and you build up levels of trust amongst people that understand the situation, understand the technologies, the possibilities, the options. And, you know, it's so it's a multi-pronged kind of thing. Another thing we do is during our research planning, we have representatives from the program offices as well as from the regions that are providing input as to research directions and what those needs are, what those real world needs are. And I think all that, you know, it's not just like a one silver bullet. You've got to come from different angles. And so from FRTR's perspective, I think, you know, one major thing, and this has been said by others, that, you know, having conferences such as this and getting into the more technical aspects and you know, perhaps having trainings for folks. And not only are you building up on the knowledge base, but you're then building up also with the communication and the connections and networking of the people from the different agents. I'm taking my thoughts from the EPA perspective and expanding them out to the multi-agency perspective that FRTR works at, so that you get these connections, you get the knowledge and perspectives on things. And I think that when people work together, know each other, build levels of trust, and have an ability, you know, to know about the problems and the potential fixes and which ones work and which ones don't in particular circumstances, it all fits together. I think it's I have an ecological background, so it's sort of I think multi-pronged network systems kind of thinking. But it just doesn't take one path. It takes many, I think, to be most successful.
All right. Thank you, sir. Any final thoughts, Trish, on activities FRTR might undertake? And then we'll move off of this Valley of Death question. We're quickly running through our allotted time.
Well, thank you. And I'll support what Charles was saying about education, and we can work together on educating the industry. But more importantly, we could use your help on our subsurface workshop, because, you know, we're looking at ways we can develop technical basis for guidance for conducting and evaluating surveys of residual radioactivity. And I think this group could be instrumental in helping us formulate that guidance.
Okay, thank you. We have had a ton of audience questions. Many of them are very specific to a particular member of FRTR, and I don't want to take time up with them today, but these questions will get sent to the appropriate agency, and you, if we've got your contact information, you know, you didn't come in as an anonymous question, then we can get back and give you an answer on that. So give us a couple of weeks to do that, but it will happen. Kind of sorting through all these, I really appreciate all the input from the audience. Let's see here. One question just came in kind of early in the mix here, and the question was, is there a work group that looks at prevention and lessons learned from remediation and investigation of specific contamination sites, events, or threats, and communicating that information for planning and future protection? And to me, I'm not quite sure what planning means there, whether it's planning remediation or something else, but this question seems to have two prongs to it, one dealing with perhaps remedies selection and optimization, and the other having to do with pollution prevention. So I think I'd like to ask Jeff Plumlee to weigh in on this topic, if you would, a bit.
Great. Thanks, Kent. Well, first I want to stress that each site is different, and so each site will have its own particular set of idiosyncrasies and challenges and things like that, depending on what the contaminant or contaminant mixtures are, what the geology, hydrology, surface extent, surface characteristics, things like that. But and the other aspect that I want to stress is too that I would need to defer to somebody who has much more detailed knowledge of FRTR to know whether there's actually a working group dealing with this. But I can say that very clearly in the USGS experience, we found that even though each site is different, there are certain key things that we can look for and learn lessons about from one site and apply them to next site. And one quick example is the use of plugging of draining tunnels, mine tunnels. And we've actually done analyses to show where those actually do work and other places where, because of the site hydrology, there are a lot of fractures that intersect between the mine workings and the surface that actually turn a point source into a bunch of non-point, into a bunch of point sources, creating one big non-point source. Many times utilizing the natural drainage patterns that were there before mining even started. The other thing, USGS, one of the things I did as a scientist before going into senior management was working on environmental disasters. And one of the things we saw there that the particular contaminants that are produced by different types of environmental disasters, like wildfires versus floods versus things like that, actually you can do quite a bit to understand what there might be in the way of remediation challenges and actual impacts based on a knowledge of similar previous disasters. So lessons learned is actually a big way to actually help not only understand what might develop at a site before that needs to be prevented rather than occurring, or that might help in the cleanup or remediation. Thanks.
Heather, I know you wanted to say something to this question specifically. So Heather Henry.
Thanks, Kent. And I put this through the chat, but there is, in terms of working groups, there is out of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, there is an emerging contaminants drinking water working group. And they just released into the Federal Register a opportunity for comment on several questions related to how best to communicate issues about emerging contaminants in drinking water, and then also what are the research needs. So to address the prevention part of the question from our audience, I would direct you to that. And I'll just pop that through one more time so it's fresh in the chat box. Thanks, Kent.
Okay. Gunardi, did you have anything you wanted to add to the discussion on this question from the Navy?
Oh, I think from the end user perspective, which is basically all of us in the program, I think knowledge transfer and lesson learned in the communication, it's absolutely, it has to be a two-way street. And I mentioned FRTR can definitely play a crucial role. I mentioned earlier about the technology matrix, just the simplicity of it, it just make it so useful. And if we can all make sure that whatever we've done in our program in terms of implementing technologies, what the lesson learned, what's the performance and what's the cost, in whatever focus area we're on, we can make sure that we maintain the currency and the relevancy of the technology matrix and probably expand it. I think that would help a lot because our remedial project managers in the field, they would have to like tackle so many competing priorities, and just the ability to be able to just go to a simple matrix similar to what FRTR is currently have to make when it's current, and we all can make sure that it's current, then I think it will be a great help. So we can just So it's like a one-way stop, like we can just go there and then find information.
Okay, I'm going to check in with Jean here. How are we doing on time, Jean? Are we about at the point where we need to turn this off?
Yes, we are definitely at about that point, as we have one other speaker left today.
Okay, there are a lot of really good questions here. I just want to assure everybody that's participating, attending this today, that we take these this input and these questions seriously. And if there's a question that perhaps you have that you're not getting an answer to, and it's not specific to a particular agency, contact me or Jean or any of the members of the steering committee, and we'll try and get some information back to you. The goal of this again is to gather information and then move on to a plan for the coming months and years. So I think I'll draw this discussion to a close. I think we could go on a couple more hours if we had the time, but we don't. And so I want to thank all of our panelists today, and I really appreciate the effort you put into this. So thank you. I'm going to now turn the program over to Dan Powell. There he is. And it's my pleasure to introduce him, Dan from the EPA, who will provide us with a final presentation. Dan is kind of wearing two hats right now at the EPA, but in general, he leads efforts to promote awareness and use of best practices, innovative technologies for site cleanup at hazardous waste sites across the EPA's waste programs. Manages education technology support, information programs to support site project managers within EPA state and local level. He's been with the Technology Innovation Program, now part of the Office of Superfund Remediation Technology Innovation, since 1990, which is probably about the time he got involved with FRTR2, I suppose. He joined the agency a couple of years earlier. He's worked in several offices and programs. He holds a master's in public administration from University of Virginia, a BA from Roanoke, and he has a nice stream behind him. So there you go, Dan.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And just a lot of, you know, first of all, I want to say, you know, just as my experience of working with the roundtable since the fall of 1990, when we had our initial meetings, it's just, it's always great to hear the perspectives of folks and just realize all the smart people we work with, not just on the roundtable, but the people who participate in these roundtable meetings too. It's always an enlightening thing. And the one point, you know, I want to make here, we spent a lot of time talking about technical and technology and engineering elements of remediation, which it is. But, you know, one of the things at the roundtable, I think, that hits home to me, particularly with my background in public administration, is we're all government agencies, we're all civil servants here. And the continuity of the roundtable and the ability to collaborate, exchange ideas, build on each other's work is, to me, the epitome of good public administration. You know, we've had our successes. We have other places we haven't been as successful for, but we continue to try to strive to, you know, most effectively clean up these waste sites and leverage the investments that the public is making in these technologies. Gene, if you go to the next slide, I'm not going to go too far into this slide because we've heard a lot about this over the course of the last, and you can go ahead and hit the animation. So kind of a nice view. We talk about the Valley of Death. It sounds kind of ominous and everything, but if you're standing back, okay, maybe not so bad, but depending on your perspective. But you could go through, just for sake, yeah, one more, there we go. And, you know, the concept of this idea, the Valley of Death, is trying to move from this research scale, this bench scale, pilot scale, moving into the, to, you know, getting into prime time and getting people who are actually cleaning up the sites what they need. And really, I think you heard about a lot of the challenges of the people on the right side of that valley, a lot of the solutions that are coming from the left side of the valley, and how you get that through. And I think the roundtable, by providing, you know, some of the information exchange, again, some of the leveraging of our experience and the ability to leverage that experience, While we're not going to bridge that valley, while we're not going to drive people through the valley, I think we can provide some of the tools that people need to get there. And I think the two parts I want to emphasize is, you know, number one, from the user side, which was your first panel, you know, we need to be clear about what we need in terms of the technologies and be specific in identifying our information needs and technology needs. And what it's going to take to get that acceptance. And on the other side, on the research side, I think it's a matter of understanding what those needs are and what kind of the realities, once you're in the middle of that valley, when you're starting to get out to a site and realize some of the challenges you're facing that are both technical, logistical, administrative, you know, how you can get through that. So Gene, we can go, we'll just skip ahead one more slide. We're going to move on here to the next slide. There we go. And I think the point here is that, you know, typically the research pipelines or paths, so to speak, moves from basic, you know, and you see the five kind of primary stages that people have used for a lot of years to point that out. I think it's not necessarily, you need to view it more as a cyclical and feedback loops and things like that. It's not a linear process. As you move to each stage of the process, you know, moving from the bench scale to getting some access to do further research in the field, to scaling up to the pilot scale, to actually doing some treatability testing and demonstration and field full scale use, you're constantly learning. I think the roundtable, you know, serves a valuable role as you, you know, you've heard some of the different programs that are out there. They're doing such great work in sharing information and understanding. All right, we took this technology out to the field and we found out that, for example, the wells were getting fouled. You know, what do we need to do to fix that problem? Or the analytical instrument we use had some interferences we weren't expecting to encounter. How do we deal with that problem? And the one thing I think we've learned over 30 years is a single demonstration project is not going to push you through that process. It's a continuing, you know, learning process. And on the other hand, one of the areas at the roundtable, hopefully to this community, continues to demonstrate is this commitment to innovation. Yeah, it's not always going to be successful, but even when it's not successful, we're going to learn the parameters and we're going to continue to share that information so that those people doing the research, going back to your valley analogy, are understanding what others have experienced, have gone there before them, and maybe how to work on that. Next slide, please. And the other part here is too, is really the understanding. There's not a one size, you know, I heard Chuck mention this, you know, silver bullets and the like, you know, it's one technology, not one size fits all for every site. The sites are different, but even in an individual site, the information that people need to decide whether they're going to use the technology, what it's going to take for them to understand it's successful and useful. What are we going to do? You know, we're talking about some of the communities we're dealing with to make sure that they understand that innovation still means protective and how are we going to push that forward? You know, again, understanding those information needs and being able to respond to those and be able to have ready access to shared information. And then the concept that the research is spread out. You heard that today. There's a lot of good work being done, not just at the federal level, but private sector, you know, states are doing some work. You know, how can we get to a point where we're leveraging each other's information and results and lessons versus duplicating the work, which was really kind of where the roundtable started. Was, you know, we were all investing. There was a lot of money back in the 90s to do this type of research, and there was a lot of projects going on. So it was, how do you kind of build that information base so that we're continually building on what each other are doing to move through that research cycle? Next slide, please, Gene. So anyway, again, you heard this over the course of the past couple of days, but you know, what are some of the keys there? Charles mentioned this, the technical support element. You know, again, it's important to make sure that the people who are using the technology don't just have information that tells them what to do. They haven't just taken the training, but they're able to get supported in applying the technologies. And the roundtables, you know, we've done a lot of work in that area, whether it's optimization, high resolution characterization. We've shared information, shared expertise to one another. You know, again, training resources is a very important part. It's not an individual training program or certification program. It's making sure that people have training resources or at the depth they need, they're at the availability they need. And, you know, I think over the last year, Mark was talking about, you know, the younger generation and how they learn and things like that. You know, I think we've all changed how we learn. And I think those changes are going to become permanent. So how do we continually provide those training resources in a way that people can use them? And then the information exchange, you know, the clearinghouse, the databases, the cost and performance information, not only to make it available, but make it easily accessible to people to use it. And I think the roundtable fills that particular need, the interagency cooperation that we've done over the years. And, you know, we've had a lot of good work over the past 30 years, but I think the key point this year is we want to figure out what we're doing moving forward. And Gene, if you can slide, I believe this will be the last slide. So what's happening here? What's our path forward? You know, number one, we had some great discussions leading up to these two meetings, and we'll continue to have some great effort, you know, over the course of the next several months to take that input, not just from each other, but also what we receive from folks who have participated in these meetings to figure out where we're going to be the next 5, 10, hopefully 30 years from now. You know, and again, identify what the sort of goals are in terms of both the content of our meetings, but also what sort of projects, are there subgroups that we can work on to move forward. From these meetings, you know, we plan on putting together PowerPoint presentations that you'll see here. They'll be recorded archives, hopefully from those you've participated in the past, but we'll continue to provide follow-on Federal Roundtable Presents webinars on the platform there that either redo some of these presentations for those people who've missed them, allows us to archive them. But also if there's some new topics that we can build off of existing presentations, we can provide those. We are going to be doing a meeting report, as Kent mentioned, summarizing the findings and putting that out there for folks. And then again, looking for other sort of, you know, number one, what sort of topics are we looking for? Are there some collaborative endeavors? There have been a large number of those over the past 30 years to focus in on specific topics, whether it's developing training or guidance, or whether it's to develop some, you know, collaborative projects in the field. We can look at all of those things. So that's kind of it. I'm trying to wrap up here a little bit beyond time. Gene, if you could slide to the last slide here. You know, this was mentioned in the last presentation. I'm just going to reiterate that. You know, the federal agencies have responded to identifying some of these challenges and needs and what it's going to take to advance technologies and what our vision for the roundtable is. We responded to that. As you heard, you know, brief snippets in the presentations, and you'll see some more in the paper that we write up following this meeting. But, you know, folks have thoughts, you know, a question they forgot to ask or a comment they wanted to make. Please, you know, feel free to provide that to us. We'd love to hear that. Again, we're a public, you know, these are all public agencies, and we can take feedback from where we can get it. So, you know, that being said, I think we're going to wind down here and hand it back to Gene. But, you know, again, I think I just want to express my appreciation to just the speakers that you heard last week and this week, the people who supported them in putting these presentations together. The organizers and, you know, folks like Gene who moderate, and there's a number of folks behind the scene too who put this on and make it go somewhat seamlessly. You know, all those folks really, you know, not just at this meeting, but, you know, over the course of the last, you know, 30 years of existence have really kind of pulled together to make this happen. And I want to express my appreciation for not just the work that's being done here, but the ability and the honor to work with all the folks that we've worked with over the years. It's really been something I really do treasure. So with that, I'm going to hand it back to Gene.
All right. Thank you so very much, Dan. I appreciate that. I'm going to walk through just a few quick final reminders for everyone so that we can close out the day. So the first thing that I want to do is just remind everybody, you've heard the CLUIN websites, TechDirect newsletter, our ongoing webinars referenced by a number of our speakers today. So I encourage you to visit us at the CLUIN website at cluin.org. And be sure to visit the TechDirect area, because on the first of each month, I send out a monthly newsletter that would highlight webinars like today, along with a collection of other technical documents and web resources related to hazardous waste site characterization and cleanup. So please be sure to connect with us and sign up for our resources. As noted earlier today, copies of all of the presentation materials, including all of those agency announcements that we were looping during our break, are already available on the seminar homepage. So you can bookmark this website and access it. Along the top of it, there are tabs to get to information about our speakers, download the slides, look at related resources, and even provide feedback. A number of you have asked if we offer PDHs or CEUs, and while I do not issue those types of credit hours for our webinars, I can provide you with the participation certificate if you follow the link to the feedback form for today's session and fill that out. But please be sure when you fill that form out that you check the box at the bottom of the form certifying you were here for the whole thing and requesting a certificate. If you don't check that box, no certificate will be generated. Assuming you do that, you'll immediately have access to a certificate that you can download or print and save for your own records. If you had multiple people joining at your particular location, each person can fill out that feedback form, even if they didn't register on their own. So I ask those of you who may have hosted a viewing party at your location to be sure to share the link to that seminar homepage so they can give us their own feedback form to get their own certificates. Our session today was recorded just like part one, and we will post it on the CLUIN archive page. It usually takes us about a week or so, but you'll be able to replay the entire set of dialogues from both part one and part two. I'll also be sending out a follow-up email with links to those archives as soon as they're available, along with a collection of the questions and just a reminder to share your thoughts in writing by email for those who wish to do so. So with that, I want to echo the thanks. We did have an international group of attendees joining us today. We had nearly 350 people on for the live events. I want to thank all of the presenters, all of the organizers, all of those staff on, and each and every one of you who joined us for today's session. So with that, I'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. And I